and he collapsed on the cobblestones as if Garion's touch had been some colossal blow. Then Barak nudged his horse between Garion and the fallen man.
"What's this all about?"
he demanded of the second-robed man who ran up, gasping for breath.
"We're from Moteren," the man answered. "Brother Ober, he could not stand the ghosts anymore. So I was given permission to bring him home until his sanity returned."
He knelt over the fallen man.
"You did not have to hit him so hard," he accused.
"But I didn't," Garion protested. "I only touched him. I think he fainted."
"You must have hit him," the monk said. "Look at this mark on his face."
An ugly red welt stood on the unconscious man's forehead.
"Garion," Aunt Paul said, "can you do exactly what I tell you to do, without asking any questions?"
Garion nodded.
"I think so." "Get down off of your horse. Go to the man on the ground and put the palm of your hand on his forehead. Then apologize to him for knocking him down."
"Are you sure it's safe, Bulgera?"
Barak asked. "It will be all right. Do as I told you, Garion."
Garion hesitantly approached the stricken man, reached out and laid his palm on the ugly welt.
"I'm sorry. And I hope you get well soon."
There was a surge in his arm again, but quite different from the first one. The madman's eyes cleared, and he blinked.
"Where am I? What happened?"
His voice sounded very normal, and the welt on his forehead was gone.
"It's all right now," Garion told him, not knowing exactly why he said it. "You've been sick, but you're better now."
"Come along, Garion,"
Aunt Paul said. "His friend can care for him now."
Garion went back to his horse, his thoughts churning.
"It is a miracle,"
the second monk exclaimed.
"Oh, hardly that," Aunt Paul said. "The blow restored your friend's mind, that's all. It happens sometimes."
But she and Mr. Wolfe exchanged a long glance that said quite plainly that something else had happened, something unexpected. They rode on, leaving the two monks in the middle of the street.
What happened?"
Dernick asked, a stunned look on his face. Mr. Wolfe shrugged.
"Bulgera had to use Garion," he said. "There wasn't time to do it any other way."
Dernick looked unconvinced.
"We don't do it often," Wolfe explained. "It's a little cumbersome to go through someone else like that. But sometimes we don't have any choice." "But Garion healed him," Dernick objected.
"It has to come from the same hand as the blow, Dernick," Aunt Paul said. "Please don't ask so many questions."
The dry awareness in Garion's mind, however, refused to accept any of their explanations. It told him that nothing had come from outside. With a troubled face, he studied the silvery mark on his palm. It seemed different for some reason.
"Don't think about it, dear,"
Aunt Paul said quietly as they left the village and rode south along the highway.
"It's nothing to worry about. I'll explain it later."
Then, to the caroling of birds that greeted the rising sun, she reached across and firmly closed his hand with her fingers. Chapter 13. It took them 3 days to pass through the forest of Vordu. Garion, remembering the dangers of the Erendish forest, was apprehensive at first and watched the shadows beneath the trees nervously. But after a day or so with nothing out of the ordinary occurring, he began to relax. Mr. Wolfe, however, seemed to grow increasingly irritable as they rode south.
"They're planning something. But I wish they'd get on with it. I hate to ride with one eye over my shoulder every step of the way."
Garion had little opportunity along the way to speak with Aunt Paul about what had happened to the crazy monk from Mar Terran. It seemed almost as if she were deliberately avoiding him. When he finally did manage to ride briefly beside her and question her about the incident, her answers were vague and did little to quiet his unease about the whole affair. It was the middle of the morning on the third day when they emerged from the trees and rode out into the open farmland. Unlike the Erendish plain, where vast tracts of land seemed to lie fallow, the ground here was extensively cultivated, and low stone walls surrounded each field. Although it was still far from being warm, the sun was very bright, and the well-turned earth in the fields seemed rich and black as it lay waiting for sowing. The highway was broad and straight, and they encountered frequent travelers along the way. Greetings between the party and these travelers were restrained but polite, and Garion began to feel more at ease. This country appeared to be much too civilized for the kind of dangers they had encountered in Arendia. About mid-afternoon, they rode into a sizable town where merchants in variously colored mantles called to them from booths and stalls which lined the streets, imploring them to stop and look at the merchandise.
They sound almost desperate, Durnick said.
Dolnedrans hate to see a customer get away. They're greedy, Silk told him.
Ahead in a small square, a disturbance suddenly broke out. A half-dozen slovenly, unshaven soldiers had accosted an arrogant-looking man in a green mantle.
"Stand aside, I say," the arrogant man protested sharply.
"We just don't want a word or two with you, Limbor," one of the soldiers said, with an evil-looking leer.
He was a lean man with a long scar down one side of his face.
"What an idiot," a passerby observed with a callous laugh. "Limbor's gotten so important that he doesn't think he has to take any precautions."
"Is he being arrested, friend?" Durnick inquired politely.
"Only temporarily," the passerby said dryly.
"What are they going to do with him, then?" Durnick asked.
"The usual."
And what's the usual?"
"Watch and see. The fool should have known better than to come out without his bodyguards."
The soldiers had surrounded the man in the green mantle, and two of them took hold of his arms roughly.
"Let me go," Limbor protested. "What do you think you are doing?"
"I just get along quietly then, Limbor," the scar-faced soldier ordered.
"It'll be a lot easier that way."
They began pulling him toward a narrow alleyway.
"Help!"
Limbor shouted, desperately trying to struggle. One of the soldiers smashed the captive in the mouth with his fist, and they pulled him into the alley. There was a single short scream, and the sounds of a brief scuffle. There were other sounds as well, a few grunts, and the grating sound of steel on bone, then a long, sighing moan. A wide rivulet of bright blood trickled out of the mouth of the alley and ran into the gutter. A minute or so later, the soldiers came back out into the square, grinning and wiping their swords.
"We've got to do something,"
Garion said, sick with outrage and horror.
"No," Silk said bluntly. "What we have to do is to mind our own business. We're not here to get involved in the local politics."
"Politics?" Garion objected. "That was deliberate murder. Shouldn't we at least see if he's still alive?"
"Not too likely," Barak said. "Siegsmen with swords can usually do a pretty thorough job."
A dozen other soldiers, as shabby-looking as the first group, ran into the square with drawn swords.
"Too late, Trabas,"
the scar-faced soldier laughed harshly to the leader of the newcomers.
"Limbor doesn't need you any more. He just came down with a bad case of dead. It looks like you are out of work."
The one called Rabas stopped, his expression dark. Then a look of brutal cunning spread across his face.
"Maybe you are right, Krager."
His voice was harsh.
"But then again, we might be able to create a few vacancies in Elgin's garrison. I am sure that he would be happy to hire good replacements."
He began to move forward again, his short sword swinging in a low, dangerous arc. Then there came the sound of a jingling trot, and 20 legionnaires in a double column came into the square, their feet striking the cobblestones in unison. They carried short lances, and they stopped between the two groups of soldiers. Each column turned to face one group, their lances leveled. The breastplates of the legionnaires were brightly burnished, and their equipment was spotless.
All right, Travis, Craig, that is enough,
the sergeant in charge said sharply.
I want both of you off of the street immediately. Are these swine Kilimber, sergeant?
Travis protested.
That's too bad,
the sergeant said without much sympathy.
Now, clear the streets. There is not going to be any brawling while I am on duty.
Rabas demanded in return.
Aren't you going to do something?
I am, the legionnaire said.
I am clearing the street. Now get out of here.
Sullenly, Rabas turned and led his men out of the square.
That goes for you too, Krager, the sergeant ordered.
Of course, sergeant,
Krager said with an oily smirk.
We were just leaving anyway.
A crowd had gathered, and there were several boos as the legionnaires herded the sloppy-looking soldiers out of the square. The sergeant looked around, his face dangerous, and the boos died immediately. Dernick hissed sharply.
Over there, far side that square,
he said to Wolf in a hoarse whisper.
Isn't that Brill?
Again?
Wolf's voice held exasperation.
How does he keep getting ahead of us like this?
Let's find out what he's up to, Silk suggested, his eyes bright.
He would recognize any of us if we tried to follow him,
Brack warned. Oh, leave that to me, Silk said, sliding out of his saddle.
Did he see us?
Garion asked.
I don't think so. Stop and see those men over there, said Dernick. He isn't looking this way.
There's an inn near the south end of town, Silk said, quickly pulling off his vest and tying it to the saddle. I'll meet you there in an hour or so. Then the little man turned and disappeared into the crowd.
Get down off your horses,
Mr. Wolf ordered tersely.
We'll lead them.
They all dismounted and led their mounts slowly around the edge of the square, staying close to the buildings and keeping the animals between themselves and Brill as much as possible. Garion glanced once up the narrow alleyway where Krager and his men had dragged the protesting Limbor. He shuddered and looked away quickly. A green mantled heap lay in a grimy corner, and there was blood splashed thickly on the walls and the filthy cobblestones in the alley. After they had moved out of the square, they found the entire town seething with excitement, and in some cases, consternation.
Limbor, you say?
An ashen-faced merchant in a blue mantle exclaimed to another shaken man.
Impossible! My brother just talked to a man who was there,
the second merchant said.
A 48th of Elgon's soldiers attacked him in the street. They cut him down right in front of the crowd.
What's it going to happen to us?
The first man asked in a shaking voice.
I don't know about you, but I am going to hide. Now that Limbor's dead, Elgon's soldiers are probably going to try to kill us all. But they would not dare. Who is going to stop them now? I am going home. Why did we listen to Limbor?
The first merchant wailed.
We could have stayed out of this whole business. It's too late now,
the second man said.
Am I going to go home and bar my doors?
He turned and scurried away. The first man stared after him, and then he too turned and fled.
They play for keeps, don't they?
Berek observed.
Why do the legions allow it?
Mandorallan wanted to know.
The legions stay neutral in these affairs,
Wolf told them.
It is part of their oath.
The inn to which Silk had directed them was a neat square building surrounded by a low wall. They tied their horses in the courtyard and went inside.
We might as well eat, Father,
Aunt Paul said, seating herself at a table of well-scrubbed oak in the sunny common room.
I was just...
Wolf looked toward the door which led into the tap room.
I know, she said, but I think we should eat first.
Wolf sighed.
All right, Paul.
The serving man brought them a platter of smoking cutlets and heavy slabs of brown bread soaked in butter. Garion's stomach was still a bit shaky after what he had witnessed in the square, but the smell of the cutlets soon overcame that. They had nearly finished eating when a shabby-looking little man in a linen shirt, leather apron, and a ragged hat came in and plunked himself unceremoniously at the end of their table. His face looked vaguely familiar, somehow.
"Wine," he bawled at the serving man, "and food."
He squinted around in the golden light streaming through the yellow glass windows of the common room.
"There are other tables, friend," Manderolin said coldly.
But I like this one," the stranger said.
He peered at each of them in turn, and then he suddenly laughed. Garion stared in amazement as the man's face relaxed, the muscles seeming to shift under his skin back into their normal position. It was Silk.
"How did you do that?" Beric asked, startled.
Silk grinned at him and then reached up to massage his cheeks with his fingertips.
"Concentration, Beric. Concentration and lots of practice. Makes my jaws ache a bit, though."
"Useful skill, I would imagine,
under the right circumstances," Hetar said blandly.
"Particularly for a spy," Beric said.
Silk bowed mockingly.
"Where'd you get those clothes?"
Durnik asked. "Stole them," Silk shrugged, peeling off the apron.
"So, what is Brill doing here?"
Wolf asked.
"Oh, stirring up trouble. Same as always," Silk replied. "He's telling people that a Murgo named Asherek is offering a reward for any information about us. Oh, he describes you quite well, old friend. Not very flatteringly, but quite well. I expect we will have to deal with this Asherek before long," Aunt Paul said. "He is beginning to irritate me." "Oh, there's another thing," Silk started on one of the cutlets. "Brill's telling everyone that Garion is Asherak's son, and that we've stolen him, and that Asherak's offering a huge reward for his return."
"Garion?"
Aunt Paul asked sharply. Silk nodded.
The kind of money he's talking about is bound to make everyone in Tol Nedra keep his eyes open."
He reached for a piece of bread. Garion felt a sharp pang of anxiety.
"Why me?"
"It will delay us," Wolf said. "Asherak, whoever he is, knows that Polgara would stop to look for you. So would the rest of us, most likely. That would give Zadar time to get away."
"Just who is Asherak?"
Hetar wanted to know, his eyes narrowing.
"A Grolem, I expect," Wolf answered. "His operations are a little too widespread for him to be an ordinary Murgo."
"I can one tell a difference, though?" Durnik asked.
"You can't," Wolf answered. "They look very much the same. They are two separate tribes, but they're much more closely related to each other than they are to other Ingraks. Anyone can tell the difference between a Nadrak and a Thul, or a Thul and a Malorian. But the Murgos and Grolems are so much alike that they can't tell them apart."
"I've never had any problem," Aunt Paul said. "Their minds are quite different."
"Oh, that will make it much easier," Beric commented dryly. "We'll just chop open the head of the next Murgo we meet, and you can point out the differences to us."
"You have been spending too much time with Silk lately," Aunt Paul said acidly. "You're starting to talk like him."
Beric looked over at Silk and winked.
"Let's finish up here, and see if we can't get out of town quietly. Is there a back alley out of this place?"
Wolf asked Silk.
"Oh, naturally," Silk said, still eating.
"Are you familiar with it?"
"Please," Silk looked a bit offended. "Of course I'm familiar with it."
Let it pass," Wolf said.
The alleyway Silk led them through was narrow, deserted, and smelled quite bad, but it brought them to the town's south gate, and they were soon on the highway again.
"A little distance would not hurt at this point," Wolf said.
He thumped his heels to his horse's flanks and started off at a gallop. They rode until well after dark. The moon, looking swollen and unhealthy, rose slowly above the horizon and filled the night with a pale light that seemed to leach away all traces of color. Wolf finally pulled to a stop.
"There's really no point in riding all night. Let's move off of the road and get a few hours' sleep now. We will start out again early. I would like to stay ahead of Brill this time, if we can."
"Over there?"
Durnick suggested, pointing at a small copse of trees looming black in the moonlight not far from the road.
"Mm-hmm, it will do," Wolf decided. "I don't think we'll need a fire."
They led the horses in among the trees and pulled their blankets out of their packs. The moonlight filtered in among the trees and dappled the leaf-strewn ground. Geryon found a fairly level place with his feet rolled up in his blankets, and after squirming around a bit, he fell soundly asleep. He awoke suddenly, his eyes dazzled by the light of a half-dozen torches. A heavy foot was pushed down on his chest, and the point of a sword was set firmly, uncomfortably, against his throat.
"Well, nobody move," a harsh voice ordered. "We will kill anybody who moves."
Geryon stiffened in panic, and the sword point at his throat dug in sharply. He rolled his head from side to side and saw that all of his friends were being held down in the same way. Durnick, who had been standing guard, was held by two rough-looking soldiers, and a piece of rag was stuffed in his mouth.
"What does this mean?" Silk demanded of the soldiers.
"You'll find out,"
the one in charge rasped.
"Get their weapons."
As he gestured, Geryon saw that a finger was missing from his right hand.
"There's a mistake here," Silk said. "I'm Redek of Boktor, a merchant, and my friends and I haven't done anything wrong."
"Get on your feet,"
the three-fingered soldier ordered, ignoring the little man's objections.
"If any one of you tries to get away, we will kill all of the rest."
Silk rose and crammed on his cap.
"You are going to regret this, Captain. I have got powerful friends here in Tol'Nedra."
The soldier shrugged.
"That doesn't mean anything to me. I take my orders from Count Drevor. He told me to bring you in."
"All right. Let's go see this Count Drevor. We'll get this cleared up right now, and there is no need for waving your swords around. We'll come along quietly. None of us is going to do anything to get you excited." The three-fingered soldier's face darkened in the torchlight.
"I don't like your tone, merchant."
"You're not being paid to like my tone, friend. You're being paid to escort us to Count Drevor. Now suppose we get moving. The quicker we get there, the quicker I can give him a full report about your behavior."
"Get their horses,"
the soldier growled. Geryon had edged over to Aunt Paul.
"Can't you do anything?"
he asked her quietly.
"No talking,"
the soldier who had captured him barked. Geryon stood helplessly, staring at the sword leveled at his chest. Chapter 14. The house of Count Drevor was a large white building set in the center of a broad lawn with clipped hedges and formal gardens on either side. The moon, fully overhead now, illuminated every detail as they rode slowly up a white-graveled curving road that led to the house. The soldiers ordered them to dismount in the courtyard between the house and the garden on the west side of the house, and they were hustled inside and down a long hallway to a heavy, polished door. Count Drevor was a thin, vague-looking man with deep pouches under his eyes, and he sprawled in a chair in the center of a richly furnished room. He looked up with a pleasant, almost dreamy smile on his face as they entered. His mantle was a pale rose color, with silver trim at the hem and around the sleeves to indicate his rank. It was badly wrinkled and none too clean.
"And who are these guests?"
he asked, his voice slurred and barely audible.
"The prisoners, my lord," the three-fingered soldier explained. "These are the ones you ordered arrested."
"Did I order someone arrested?"
the count asked, his voice still slurred.
"What a remarkable thing for me to do. I hope that I have not inconvenienced you, my friends."
We were a bit surprised, that's all, Silk said carefully. I wonder why I did that, the Count pondered. I must have had a reason. I never do anything without a reason. What has you done wrong?
We have not done anything wrong, my lord, Silk assured him.
Then why? What have you arrested? There must be some sort of mistake.
That's what we thought, my lord.
Well, I am glad that's all cleared up, the Count said happily. May I offer you some dinner, perhaps?
We've already eaten, my lord.
Oh, the Count's face fell with disappointment. I have so few visitors.
Perhaps you still have this. May I remember the reason these people were detained, my lord?
The three-fingered soldier suggested.
Yes, of course, the Count said. What did I think of it? Idris remembers everything. Please, send for him at once.
Yes, my lord.
The soldier bowed and jerked his head curtly at one of his men. Count Drevor dreamily began playing with one of the folds of his mantle, humming tunelessly as they waited. After a few moments, a door at the end of the room opened, and a man in an iridescent and intricately embroidered robe entered. His face was grossly sensual, and his head was shaved.
You sent for me, my lord.
His rasping voice was almost a hiss.
Ah, Edis, Count Drevor said happily. How good of you to join us. It's my pleasure to serve you, my lord, the steward said with a sinuous bow. I was so wondering why I asked these friends to stop by, the Count said. I seem to have forgotten. Do you by any chance recall? It is just a small matter, my lord, the steward answered. I can easily handle it for you. You need your rest. You mustn't overtire yourself, you know.
The Count passed a hand across his face.
Now that you mention it, I do feel a little bit fatigued. It is. Perhaps you can entertain our guests while I rest a bit. Yes, of course, my lord,
it is said with another bow. The Count shifted around in his chair and almost immediately fell asleep.
The Count is in delicate health,
it is said with an oily smile.
He seldom leaves that chair these days. Let's move away a bit, so that we don't disturb him.
I am only a Drasnian merchant, your eminence, and these are my servants, except for my sister there. We're all baffled by all of this.
Idis laughed.
Why do you persist in this absurd fiction, Prince Keldar? I know who you are. I know you all, and I know your mission.
What is your interest in this, Nason?
Mr. Wolf asked bluntly.
I serve my mistress, Eternal Salimisra,
Idis said. Has the Snake Woman become the pawn of the Grolems, then? Or does she bow to the will of Zadar? Aunt Paul asked.
My queen bows to no man, Palgara,
Idis said scornfully. Really? She raised one eyebrow. It's curious to find her servant dancing to a Grolem tune, then.
I have no dealings with the Grolems,
Idis said.
They are scouring all Tanitra for you. But I am the one who found you.
Finding isn't keeping, Idis,
Mr. Wolf stated quietly.
Suppose you tell us what this is all about.
I will tell you only what I feel like telling you, Belgarath.
I think that's about enough, Father. We really don't have time for Nyssen riddle games, do we?
Aunt Paul said.
Don't do it, Pagara, it is warned. I know all about your powers. My soldiers will kill your friends if you so much as raise your hand.
Geryon felt himself roughly grabbed from behind, and a sword blade was pressed firmly against his throat. Aunt Paul's eyes blazed suddenly.
You're walking on dangerous ground.
I don't think we need to exchange threats, Mr. Wolf said. I gather, then, that you don't intend to turn us over to the Grollums.
I am not interested in the Grollums, Idis said. My queen has been instructing me to deliver you to her and Stithis Tor.
What is Selmisra's interest in this matter? Wolf asked. It doesn't concern her.
I'll let her explain that to you when you get to Stithis Tor. In the meantime, there are a few things I will require you to tell me.
I think that thou wilt have scant success in that, Mandorellan said stiffly. It is not our practice to discuss private matters with unwholesome strangers.
And I think you're wrong, my dear Baron, Idis replied with a cold smile. The cellars of this house are deep, and what happens there can be most unpleasant. I have servants highly skilled in applying certain exquisitely persuasive torments.
I do not fear thy torments, Nason, Mandorellan said contemptuously.
No, I don't imagine you do. Fear requires imagination, and you errands aren't bright enough to be imaginative. The torments, however, will wear down your will and provide entertainment for my servants. Good torturers are hard to find, and they grow sullen if they aren't allowed to practice. I'm sure you understand. Later, after you have all had the chance to visit with them a time or two, we'll try something else. Yes, abounds with roots and leaves and curious little berries with strange properties. Oddly enough, most men prefer the rack or the wheel to my little concoctions.
Idis laughed then, a brutal sound with no mirth.
We'll discuss all of this further after I have the count settled for the night. For right now, the guards will take you downstairs to the places that I have prepared for you all.
Count Drevor roused himself and looked around dreamily.
Are our friends departing so soon?
He asked.
Yes, my lord,
Idis told him.
Well, then, the count said with a vague smile, farewell, dear people. I hope you will return some day so that we can continue our delightful conversation.
The cell to which Geryon was taken was dank and clammy, and it smelled of sewage and rotting food. Worst of all was the darkness. He huddled beside the iron door, with the blackness pressing in on him palpably. From one corner of the cell came little scratchings and skittering sounds. He thought of rats and tried to stay as near to the door as possible. Water trickled somewhere, and his throat began to burn with thirst.
It was dark,
but it was not silent. Chains clinked in a nearby cell. Someone, somewhere, was moaning. Farther off, there was insane laughter, a meaningless cackle repeated over and over again without pause, endlessly rattling in the dark. Someone screamed, a piercing, shocking sound, and then again. Geryon cringed back against the slimy stones of the wall, his imagination immediately manufacturing tortures to account for the agony in those screams. Time, in such a place, was non-existent. And so there was no way to know how long he had huddled in his cell, alone and afraid, before he began to hear a faint metallic scraping and clicking that seemed to come from the door itself. He scrambled away, stumbling across the uneven floor of his cell to the far wall.
"Go away!"
he cried. "Keep your voice down," Silk whispered from the far side of the door.
"Is that you, Silk?"
Geryon almost sobbed with relief. "Well, who were you expecting?
How did you get loose?"
"Don't talk so much," Silk said from between clenched teeth. "Cursed rust!" he swore. Then he grunted, and there was a grating click from the door. "There!" The cell door creaked open, and the dim light from torches somewhere filtered in.
"Come along," Silk whispered. "We have to hurry."
Geryon almost ran from the cell. Aunt Paul was waiting a few steps down the gloomy stone corridor. Without a word, Geryon went to her. She looked at him gravely for a moment and then put her arms about him. They did not speak. Silk was working on another door, his face gleaming with perspiration. The lock clicked and the door creaked open. Hedhar stepped out.
"What took you so long?"
he asked Silk.
"Rust," Silk snapped in a low voice. "I'd like to flog all the jailers in this place for letting the locks get into this condition."
"Do you suppose we could hurry a bit?"
Barak suggested over his shoulder from where he stood guard.
"Do you want to do this?" Silk demanded. "Just move along as quickly as you can," Aunt Paul said. "We don't have the time for bickering just now."
She primly folded her blue cloak over one arm. Silk grunted sourly and moved on to the next door.
"Is all of this oratory actually necessary?"
Mr. Wolf, the last to be released, asked crisply as he stepped out of his cell.
"You've all been babbling like a flock of geese out here." "Prince Kereldar felt need to make observations about the condition of the locks,"
Mandor Allen said lightly. Silk scowled at him and led the way toward the end of the corridor where the torches fumed greasily onto the blackened ceiling.
"Have a care," Mandor Allen whispered urgently. "There's a guard."
A bearded man in a dirty leather jerkin sat on the floor with his back against the wall of the corridor, snoring.
"Can we get past him without waking him up?"
Durnick breathed.
"He isn't going to wake up for several hours," Barak said grimly.
The large purple swelling on the side of the guard's face immediately explained it.
"Dost think there might be others?"
Mandor Allen asked, flexing his hands.
"There were a few," Barak said. "They're sleeping, too."
"Let's get out of here, then," Wolf suggested.
"We'll take Itis with us, won't we?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"What for?"
"I'd like to talk with him at great length."
"It would be a waste of time," Wolf said.
"So Mistress involved herself in this affair. That's all we really need to know. Her motives don't really interest me all that much. Let's just get out of here as quietly as we can."
They crept past the snoring guard, turned a corner, and moved softly down another corridor.
"Did he die?"
a voice, shockingly loud, asked from behind a barred door that emitted a smoky red light.
"No,"
another voice said, "only fainted.
You pulled too hard on the lever. You have to keep the pressure steady. Otherwise they faint and you have to start over."
"That's a lot harder than I thought,"
the first voice complained.
"You're doing fine," the second voice said. "The rack's always tricky. Just remember to keep a steady pressure and not to jerk the lever. They usually die if you pull their arms out of the sockets."
Aunt Paul's face went rigid, and her eyes blazed briefly. She made a small gesture and whispered something. A brief, hushed sound murmured in Geryon's mind.
"You know," the first voice said rather faintly, "suddenly, I don't feel so good."
"Now that you mention it, I don't either,"
the second voice agreed.
"Did that meat we had for supper taste all right to you?"
It seemed all right.
There was a long pause.
I really don't feel good at all.
They tiptoed past the barred door, and Garion carefully avoided looking in. At the end of the corridor was a stout oak door bound with iron. Silk ran his fingers around the handle.
It is locked from the outside, he whispered.
Someone is coming,
Hetar warned. There was the tramp of heavy feet on the stone stairs beyond the door, the murmur of voices and a harsh laugh. Wolf turned quickly to the door of a nearby cell. He touched his fingers to the rusty iron lock, and it clicked smoothly.
In here,
he whispered. They all crowded into the cell, and Wolf pulled the door shut behind them.
When we have got some leisure, I want to talk to you about that, Silk said.
You were having such a good time with the locks that I didn't want to interfere,
Wolf smiled blandly. Now listen. We're going to have to deal with these men before they find out that our cells are empty and rouse the whole house.
We can do that,
Barak said confidently. They waited.
Opening the door, Durnik whispered.
How many are there?
Mandarallan asked.
I can't tell.
Eight,
Aunt Paul said firmly.
All right, Barak decided. We'll let them pass and then jump on them from behind. A scream or two won't matter much in a place like this. But let's put them down quickly.
They waited tensely in the darkness of the cell.
It is says it doesn't matter. You'll see them die under the questioning,
one of the men outside said.
The only ones we have to keep alive are the old man, the woman, and the boy.
Let us kill the big one with the red whiskers, then,
another suggested.
He looks like he might be troublesome, and he's probably too stupid to know anything useful.
I want that one,
Barak whispered. The men in the corridor passed their cell.
Let's go, Barak said.
It was a short, ugly fight. They swarmed over the startled jailers in a savage rush. Three were down before the others fully realized what was happening. One made a startled outcry, dodged past the fight, and ran back toward the stairs. Without thinking, Garion dove in front of the running man. Then he rolled, tangling the man's feet and tripping him up. The guard fell, started to rise, then sagged back down in a limp heap as Silk neatly kicked him just below the ear.
Are you all right? Silk asked.
Garion squirmed out from under the unconscious jailer and scrambled to his feet, but the fight was nearly over. Durnik was pounding a stout man's head against the wall, and Barak was driving his fist into another's face. Mandarallan was strangling a third, and Hetar stalked a fourth, his hands out. The wide-eyed man cried out once, just as Hetar's hands closed on him. The tall Algar straightened, spun about, and slammed the man into the stone wall with terrific force. There was the grating sound of bones breaking, and the man went limp.
Nice little fight, Barak said, rubbing his knuckles.
Entertaining,
Hetar agreed, letting the limp body slide to the floor.
Are you about through? Silk demanded hoarsely from the door by the stairs.
Almost, Barak said. Need any help, Durnik?
Durnik lifted the stout man's chin and examined the vacant eyes critically. Then he prudently banged the jailer's head against the wall once more and let him fall.
Shall we go?
Hetar suggested.
Might as well,
Barak agreed, surveying the littered corridor.
The door's unlocked at the top of the stairs, Silk said as they joined him, and the hallway's empty beyond it. The house seems to be asleep, but let's be quiet.
They followed him silently up the stairs. He paused briefly at the door.
Wait here a moment, he whispered.
Then he disappeared, his feet making absolutely no sound. After what seemed a long time, he returned with the weapons the soldiers had taken from them.
I thought we might need these.
Garion felt much better after he had belted on his sword.
Let's go, Silk said, and led them to the end of the hall and around a corner.
I think I'd like some of the greenie. This
Count Drevor's voice came from behind a partially open door.
"Certainly, my lord,"
Idas said in his sibilant, rasping voice.
"The green tastes bad,"
Count Drevor said drowsily,
"but it gives me such lovely dreams. The red tastes better, but the dreams, they are not so nice."
"Soon you'll be ready for the blue, my lord,"
Idas promised. There was a faint clink and the sound of liquid being poured into a glass.
"Then the yellow, and finally, the black. The black is the best of all."
Silk led them on tiptoe past the half-open door. The lock on the outside door yielded quickly to his skill, and they all slipped out into the cool, moonlit night. The stars twinkled overhead, and the air was sweet.
"I'll go get the horses,"
Hetar said.
"Go with them, Mandarallan. We'll wait over there," Wolf said.
He pointed at the shadowy garden. The two men disappeared around the corner, and the rest of them followed Mr. Wolf into the looming shadows of the hedge, which surrounded Count Drevor's garden. They waited. The night was chilly, and Geryon found himself shivering. Then there was a click of a hoof touching a stone, and Hetar and Mandarallan came back, leading the horses.
"We'd better hurry," Wolf said. "As soon as Drevor drops off to sleep, Idas is going to go down to his dungeon and find out that we have left. Lead the horses. Let's get away from the house before we start making any noise."
They went down through the moonlit garden with the horses trailing along after them until they emerged on the open lawn beyond. They mounted carefully.
"We had better hurry,"
Aunt Paul suggested, glancing back at the house.
"I bought us a little time before we left," Thuk said with a short laugh.
"How did you manage that?"
Beric asked. "When I went to get our weapons, I also set fire to the kitchen," Silk smirked. "That will keep their attention for a bit."
A tendril of smoke rose from the back of the house.
"Very clever,"
Aunt Paul said, with a certain grudging admiration.
"Why, thank you, my lady."
Silk made a mocking little bow. Mr. Wolf chuckled and led them away at an easy trot. The tendril of smoke at the back of the house became thicker as they rode away, rising black and oily toward the uncaring stars. Chapter 15. They rode hard for the next several days, stopping only long enough to rest the horses and catch a few hours' sleep at infrequent intervals. Geryon found that he could doze in his saddle whenever they walked the horses. He found, indeed, that if he were tired enough, he could sleep almost any place. One afternoon, as they rested from the driving pace Wolf set, he heard Silk talking to the old man and Aunt Paul. Curiosity finally won out over exhaustion, and he roused himself enough to listen.
"I'd still like to know more about Selmistra's involvement in this," the little man was saying.
"She's an opportunist. Any time there's turmoil, she tries to turn it to her own advantage."
"That means we'll have to dodge Nearson's as well as Murgo's."
Geryon opened his eyes.
"Why do they call her Eternal Selmistra?"
he asked Aunt Paul.
"Is she very old?"
"No," Aunt Paul answered. "The queens of Nyssa are always named Selmistra, that's all."
"Do you know this particular one?"
"I don't have to," she told him. "They are always exactly the same. They all look alike and act alike. If you know one, you know them all."
"She's going to be terribly disappointed with Idas," Silk observed, grinning.
"I imagine that Idas has taken some quiet, painless way out by now,"
Wolf said. "Selmistra grows a bit excessive when she's irritated."
"Is she so cruel, then?"
Geryon wanted to know.
"Not cruel, exactly," Wolf explained. "Nissans admire serpents. If you annoy a snake, he'll bite you. He's a simple creature, but very logical. Once he bites you, he doesn't hold any further grudges."
"Do we have to talk about snakes?" Silk asked in a pained voice.
"I think the horses are rested now,"
Hetar said from behind them.
We can go now.
They pushed the horses back into a gallop and pounded south toward the broad valley of the Nedrain River and Tolhunath. The sun turned warm, and the trees along the way were budding in the first days of spring. The gleaming imperial city was situated on an island in the middle of the river, and all the roads led there. It was clearly visible in the distance as they crested the last ridge and looked down into the fertile valley, and it seemed to grow larger with each passing mile as they approached it. It was built entirely of white marble, and it dazzled the eye in the mid-morning sun. The walls were high and thick, and towers soared above them within the city. A bridge arched gracefully across the rippled face of Nedrain to the bronze expanse of the north gate, where a glittering detachment of legionnaires marched perpetual guard. Silk pulled on his conservative cloak and cap and drew himself up, his face assuming that sober, business-like expression that meant that he was undergoing a private internal transition that seemed to make him almost believe himself that he was the Drasnian merchant whose identity he assumed.
"Your business in Tolhunath?" one of the legionnaires asked politely.
"I am Redek of Boktor," Silk said, with that preoccupied air of a man whose mind was on business. "I have Sindarian woolens of the finest quality."
"You probably want to talk with the steward of the central market, then," the legionnaire suggested.
"Thank you," Silk nodded, and led them through the gate into the broad and crowded streets beyond.
"I think I'd better stop by the palace and have a talk with Ran Barun," Mr. Wolf said. "The Baruns aren't the easiest emperors to deal with, but they are the most intelligent. I shouldn't have too much trouble convincing him that the situation is serious."
"How are you going to get to see him?" Aunt Paul asked. "It could take weeks to get an appointment. You know how they are."
Mr. Wolf made a sour face.
"I suppose I could make a ceremonial visit of it," he said as they pushed their horses through the crowd.
"And announce your presence to the whole city?"
"Do I have any choice? I have to nail down the Tonedrans. We cannot afford to have them neutral." "Could I make a suggestion?"
Barak asked.
"I'll listen to anything at this point." "Why don't we go see Greneg? He's the Terek ambassador here in Tolhunath. He could get us into the palace to see the emperor without all that much fuss."
"Oh, that's not a bad idea, Belgareth. Greneg's got enough connections in the palace to get us inside quickly, and Ran Barun respects him."
"That only leaves the problem of getting in to see the ambassador," Durnek said as they stopped to let a heavy wagon pass onto a side street. "He's my cousin," Barak said. "He and Anheg and I used to play together when we were children."
The big man looked around.
"He's supposed to have a house near the garrison of the 3rd Imperial Legion. I suppose we could ask somebody the way."
"Oh, that won't be necessary," Silk said. "I know where it is."
"I should have known," Barak grinned at him.
"We can go through the North Marketplace. The garrison's located near the main wharves on the downstream end of the island."
"Lead the way," Wolf told him. "I don't want to waste too much time here."
The streets of Tolhunath teemed with people from all over the world. Drasnians and Rivens rubbed elbows with Nissans and Tuls. There was a sprinkling of Nadraks in the crowd, and, to Geryon's eye, a disproportionate number of Murgos. Aunt Paul rode close beside Hetar, talking quietly to him, and frequently laying her hand lightly on his sword arm. The lean Algar's eyes burned, and his nostrils flared dangerously each time he saw a scarred Murgo face. The houses along the wide streets were imposing, with white marble facades and heavy doors, quite often guarded by private mercenary soldiers who glared belligerently at passers-by.
"The Imperial City seems awash with suspicion," Mandarallan observed. "Do they fear their neighbors so?"
"Troubled times," Silk answered, "and the merchant princes of Tolhunath keep a great deal of the world's wealth in their counting rooms. There are men along this street who could buy most of Arindia if they wanted to."
Orindia's not for sale,
Mandarallan said stiffly. In Tolhanath, my dear Baron, everything is for sale. Honor, virtue, friendship, love. Oh, it's a wicked city full of wicked people, and money is the only thing that matters.
Well, I expect that you fit right in, then,
Beric said. Silk laughed. Oh, I like Tolhanath. The people here have no illusions. They are refreshingly corrupt.
You're a very bad man, Silk,
Beric stated bluntly. So you've said before, the rat-faced little Drasnian said with a mocking grin. The banner of Terek, the outline of a white warboat on an azure background, fluttered from a pole surmounting the gate of the ambassador's house. Beric dismounted a bit stiffly and strode to the iron grill which blocked the gate.
Tell Grinig that his cousin Beric is here to see him,
he announced to the bearded guards inside.
How do we know you're his cousin?
One of the guards demanded roughly. Beric reached through the grill, almost casually, and took hold of the front of the guard's mail shirt. He pulled the man up firmly against the bars.
Would you like to rephrase that question? While you still have your health?
Oh, excuse me, Lord Beric, the man apologized quickly. Now that I am closer, I do seem to recognize your face.
I was almost sure that you would.
Let me unlock the gate for you, the guard suggested.
Excellent idea,
Beric said, letting go of the man's shirt. The guard opened the gate quickly, and the party rode into a spacious courtyard. Grinig, the ambassador of King Anheg to the imperial court of Tolhanath, was a burly man almost as big as Beric. His beard was trimmed very short, and he wore a Tolnedrin-style blue mantle. He came down the stairs two at a time and caught Beric in a vast bear hug.
You pirate! He roared. What are you doing in Tolhanath?
Anheg's decided to invade the place, Beric joked. As soon as we have rounded up the gold and young women, we're going to let you burn the city.
Grinig's eyes glittered with momentary hunger.
Wouldn't that infuriate them? He said with a vicious grin. What happened to your beard?
Grinig coughed and looked embarrassed. It's not important.
We have never had any secrets, Beric accused.
Grinig spoke quietly to his cousin for a moment, looking very ashamed of himself, and Beric burst out with a great roar of laughter.
Why did you let her do that?
I was drunk, Grinig said. Let's go inside. I've got a keg of good ale in the cellar.
The rest of them followed the two big men into the house, and they went down a broad hallway to a room with acrylic furnishings. Heavy chairs and benches covered with skins, a rush-strewn floor and a huge fireplace where the butt end of a large log smoldered. Several pitch-smeared torches smoked in iron rings on the stone wall.
I feel more at home here, Grinnick said.
A servant brought tankards of dark brown ale for them all, and then quietly left the room. Geryon quickly lifted his tankard and took a large swallow of the bitter drink before Aunt Paul could suggest something more bland. She watched him without comment, her eyes expressionless. Grinig sprawled in a large hand-hewn chair with a bearskin tossed over it.
Why are you really in Tolhanath, Beric?
Grinig,
Beric said seriously,
this is Belgorath. I am sure that you have heard of him.
The ambassador's eyes widened, and he inclined his head.
My house is yours, he said respectfully.
Can you get me in to see Ranbarun?
Mr. Wolfe asked, sitting on a rough bench near the fireplace.
Without any difficulty.
Good. I have to talk to him, and I don't want to stir up any fuss in the process.
Beric introduced the others then, and his cousin nodded politely to each of them.
You've come to Tolhanath during a turbulent period, he said after the amenities were over. The nobility of Tolnedra gathered in the city like ravens on a dead cow.
We picked up a hint or two of that on our way south, Silk told him. Is it as bad as we've had?
Probably worse, Grinnig said, scratching at one ear. Dynastic succession only happens a few times in each eon. The Boruns have been in power now for over 600 years, and the other houses are anticipating the charge over with a great deal of enthusiasm.
Who's the most likely to succeed, Ranbaran?
Mr. Wolf asked. Right at the moment, the best bet would probably be the Grand Duke Cador of Tol Vuadu, Grinnig answered. He seems to have more money than the rest. The Honoths are richer, of course, but they've got 7 candidates, and their wealth is spread out a little too thin. The other families aren't really in the running. The Boruns don't have anyone suitable, and no one takes the Ranites seriously.
Geryon carefully set his tankard on the floor beside the stool that he was sitting on. The bitter ale did not really taste that good, and he felt vaguely cheated somehow. The half-tankard he had drunk made his ears quite warm, though, and the end of his nose seemed a little numb.
A Vorduvian we met said that the Horbites are using poison, Silk said.
They all are. Grinnick wore a slightly disgusted look. The Horbites are just a little more obvious about it, that's all. If Ranbaran dies tomorrow, though, Cador will be the next emperor.
Mr. Wolf frowned.
I've never had much success dealing with the Borduvians. They don't really have imperial stature.
The old emperor is still in pretty fair health, Grinnig said. If he hangs on for another year or two, the Hornets will probably fall into line behind one candidate, whichever one survives. And then they'll be able to bring all of their money to bear on the situation. These things take time, though. The candidates themselves are staying out of town for the most part, and they're all being extremely careful, so the assassins are having a great deal of difficulty reaching them.
He laughed then, taking a long drink of ale.
They are funny people.
Can we go to the palace now?
Mr. Wolf asked.
We'll want to change clothes first, Aunt Paul said firmly.
Again, Bulgara?
Wolf gave her a long, suffering look.
Just do it, Father. I won't let you embarrass us by wearing rags to the palace.
I'm not going to wear that robe again,
the old man's voice was stubborn.
No, she said. It wouldn't be suitable. I am sure the ambassador can lend you a mantle. You won't be quite so obvious that way.
Whatever. Whatever you say, anyway, Paul.
Wolf sighed, giving up. After they had changed, Grinnig formed up his honor guard, a grim-looking group of Cherok warriors, and they were escorted along the broad avenues of Tol Hanoth toward the palace. Geryon, all bemused by the opulence of the city and feeling just a trifle giddy from the effects of the half-tankard of ale he had drunk, rode quietly beside Silk, trying not to gawk at the huge buildings or the richly dressed Tonedrin strolling with grave decorum in the noonday sun.
Chapter 16. The Imperial Palace sat on a high hill in the center of Tol Hanoth. It consisted not of one building, but rather was a complex of many large and small, all built of marble and surrounded by gardens and lawns where cypress trees cast a pleasing shade. The entire compound was enclosed by a high wall, surmounted by statues spaced at intervals along its top. The legionnaires at the palace gate recognized the Cherok ambassador and sent immediately for one of the emperor's chamberlains, a gray-haired official in a brown mantle.
I need to see Ranbaran, Lord Moran, Grinnig told him as they all dismounted in a marble courtyard just inside the palace gate. It's a matter of urgency.
Of course, Lord Grinnig, the gray-haired man assented. His Imperial Majesty is always delighted to speak with the personal envoy of King Aneg. Unfortunately, His Majesty is resting just now. I should be able to get you in to see him sometime this afternoon, tomorrow morning at the latest.
This won't wait, Morin. We have to see the Emperor immediately. You had better go to wake him up.
Lord Morin looked surprised.
It can't be that urgent, he suggested chidingly.
I'm afraid so,
Grinnig said. Morin pursed his lips thoughtfully as he looked at each member of the party.
You know me well enough to realize that I wouldn't ask this lightly, Morin, Grinnig said.
Morin sighed.
Ah, I am trusting you a great deal, Grinnig. All right, then, come along. Ask your soldiers to wait.
Grinnig made a curt gesture to his guards, and the party followed Lord Morin through a broad courtyard to a columned gallery that ran along one of the buildings.
"How's he been?"
Grinnig asked, as they walked along the shady gallery.
"His health is still good," Morin answered. "But his temper's been deteriorating lately. The Baroons have been resigning their posts and flocks and returning to Tol Barun."
"That seems prudent under the circumstances," Grinnig said. "They suspect that a certain number of fatalities are likely to accompany the secession."
Probably so," Morin agreed. "But His Majesty finds it a bit distressing to be abandoned by members of his own family."
He stopped by an arched marble gate where two legionnaires in gold-embellished breastplates stood stiffly.
"Please, leave your weapons here. His Majesty is sensitive about such things. I am sure that you can understand."
"Of course," Grinnig said, pulling a heavy sword out from under his mantle and leaning it against the wall.
They all followed his example, and Lord Morin's eyes flickered slightly with surprise when Silk removed three different daggers from various places beneath his garments.
"Formidable equipment."
The Chamberlain's hands flicked in the gestures of the secret language.
"Troubled times," Silk's fingers explained deprecatingly.
Lord Morin smiled faintly, and led them through the gate into the garden beyond. The lawn in the garden was neatly manicured. There were softly splashing fountains, and the rose bushes were well pruned. Fruit trees that seemed to be very old were budding, almost ready to burst into bloom in the warm sun. Sparrows bickered over nesting sites on the twisted limbs. Grinnig and the others followed Morin along a curving marble walk toward the center of the garden. Ran Barun the 23rd, Emperor of Tolnedra, was a small, elderly man, quite bald, and dressed in a gold-colored mantle. He lounged in a heavy chair beneath a budding grape arbor, feeding small seeds to a bright canary perched on the arm of his chair. The emperor had a little beak-like nose and bright, inquisitive eyes.
"I said I wanted to be left alone, Morin," he said in a testy voice, looking up from his canary.
"A million apologies, O Your Majesty,"
Lord Morin explained, bowing deeply.
"Lord Grinnig, the ambassador of Jerek, wishes to present you a matter of gravest urgency. He convinced me that it simply could not wait."
The emperor looked sharply at Grinnig. His eyes grew sly, almost malicious.
"I see that your beard's beginning to grow back, Grinnig."
Grinnig's face flushed slowly.
"I should have known that Your Majesty would have heard of my little misfortune."
"I know everything that happens in Tol Hanath, Lord Grinnig," the Emperor snapped. "Even if all my cousins and nephews are running like rats out of a burning house, I still have a few faithful people around me. Whatever possessed you to take up with that Dadrak woman? I thought you Elons despised Angrax."
Grinnig coughed awkwardly and glanced quickly at Aunt Paul.
"It was a kind of joke, Your Majesty. I thought it might embarrass the Dadrak ambassador. And his wife is, after all, a handsome-looking woman. I didn't know she kept a pair of scissors under her bed."